Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Ask me anything. Mark Brumley edition. If you want to ask Mark Brumley a question about the faith, he's the president of Ignatius Press, the single most important publisher in the Alpha Quadrant. And if you've got a question about the Catholic faith, it'd be pretty hard to find a better person to chat with than Mark. So pick up the phone and call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Mark, thank you for being here with us.
I'm happy to be here. Brought to you by God.
Oh, you have a sponsor now. I'm glad you have a sponsor, a divine sponsor. Congratulations. How's everything going there? You got any books you want to tell us about this time? Sometimes you got a book to tell us about.
Yeah, I do have actually a book I've been reading and talking a little bit about because we just released it. It's called God is Ever New. I'm holding it up for people who don't see the video feed. Benedict XVI, God is Ever New, Meditations on Life, Love, and Freedom, with a foreword by Pope Francis. And this is not the latest Benedict book to come out, although this one just came out. We actually got another one in called The True Europe, which came out,
wow.
Which is just out now, which is a collection of Ratzinger/Benedict essays on the topic of Europe and Christianity in Europe and so on. So I mentioned that. That's part of what are called the selected works series. There's also a collected works series that is out there and hasn't been wholly translated or published in English yet. But anyway, I'm talking too much. I just want to talk about this book a little bit, God is Ever New, because it's a wonderful little book of meditations with excerpts from papal writings and audiences and things of that sort, on just all kinds of wonderful spiritual topics, you know, meditations on God and Jesus, meditations on faith, on love, on prayer, on families, on hope, holiness, truth and freedom, meditations on joy. They're really short, you know, like one page, sometimes half a page, bite-sized, very accessible, very readable. Wonderful for devotional reading, the kind of thing you might take to a holy hour or something like that. And sometimes people will say to me, I mean, why don't I get started with Benedict XVI? You know, they have the certain presupposition, because he was a great theologian, that it's going to be hard and challenging. And it can be if you pick the wrong place to start. But there's an awful lot that Ratzinger Benedict wrote that's intended for a more general public and is very accessible. And so now I have this book as a place to recommend people start if they want to kind of have just a beginning or an access, initial point of contact with his devotional work. So God is Ever New, Benedict 16.
In a weird twist I don't know what it's a twist of, actually. I was just reading that book today. It was.
Were you?
Yeah, it was sent to me, and I was enjoying reading it. And I have mixed experience when I read Benedict's writing. I love it, and then I also feel a little bit like I wish that I could make sentences like that. Like they make you feel clearer. Like just reading the sentences, he really is a magnificent writer. I mean, a lot of popes get said, oh, what a wonderful writer he was. Yeah, I mean, but for a pope, you know, a lot of times it's like, yeah, he was a wonderful writer for a pope, but Benedict was a wonderful writer.
Yeah, he was. And you know, sometimes it can be lost depending upon who's doing the translation, but in general, the translations are pretty good, especially ours. but yeah, you'll pick up something and you will see, you can tell that even in the original German, let's say, that he could be playful. You know, he could be a very playful kind of writer. So, anyway.
Well, that's very cool. And it's out now from Ignatius Press.
It is.
And if I go,
God is
so far,
ever new.
If I go to Ignatius.com, I just type in the search bar, God is Ever New, and it'll take me there.
It will do that.
All right. All right. I'm going to do that right now. This is going to make great radio. Tippity tap, tap. All right, let's go to a call from Mark Brumley. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, is here with, yeah, that's right, president of Ignatius Press. I panicked that, like, that he was the chairman or something like that. All of a sudden, I panicked that I get the, You ever do that? Get in the middle of a sentence and, yes. And panic?
You've only been doing it. You've only been doing it for years, and all these years, it's been wrong, right?
There's some people that I have done that where they're like, that's not how you pronounce my name. Oh, sorry about
Mark
that.
Mark Brumley is actually the chief letter opener at Ignatius Press. Yes, and you've been confusing me with the president.
Mail. Yeah. but you can ask him whatever you want about the Catholic faith. He's read all the letters, so he knows a lot. 888-318-7884 is the number here. We'll start in Montana, where Joseph is watching on YouTube. Joseph, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi, thanks for raising my call. So
happy to.
My question is, so I have a friend who left the Catholic Church, and basically the reason he left was pretty much just, did his own research, kind of came to the conclusion it was basically not true. And he's just kind of wondering, like, the Catholic Church say that he's, like, made, like, a willful rejection of the Catholic Church, if it's like sincerely you believe that you're leaving the church, are you still, are you still, like, is it still like the willful rejection if you think you're pursuing truth and then you leave it even though you might be wrong?
Gotcha.
Good question. So what I would say is, I often reflect on the Lord's words on the cross when he said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they do. And the idea there is that people can do something that's wrong, but they think they're doing something that's right. And they can genuinely believe that they're doing something that's right. And they can be not blameworthy for getting to a place where they're doing something that's wrong, but they think it's right. It may not be their fault that they've got to that place. Now, does the fact that they're sincerely wrong make them right? No, it does not. But it can mean that they're not blameworthy or culpable. And someone who investigates Catholicism and, responds morally, appropriately to the evidence, but is mistaken, makes a misjudgment, misreads, misunderstands, or perhaps brings to his consideration a flawed way of looking at something or a flawed way of reasoning, and that flawed approach isn't something that he's blameworthy for, may wind up sincerely thinking the Catholic Church is wrong. Now, I think he's right about that? No, I think he's wrong about that. But that means that he's not sinning against the truth by knowingly rejecting the truth or having done something to put him – something that's wrong, to put himself in a mindset where he can no longer perceive the truth or receive the truth because of – he's perhaps – sinned his way into a hardness of heart and hardness of mind as well. So when that when you have somebody who's not in that state and they misjudge or they make a mistake or they read the evidence in the wrong way, they won't be blameworthy for that. It doesn't make them right. But what does that mean? It means if they are properly disposed to the truth, then by the disposition towards the truth and the work of the Holy Spirit, God can bring that person back. And I can't tell you, this may sound bizarre to you, but I have known people who have left the Catholic Church who had flawed understandings of what it meant to be Catholic, had something like a sincere conversion experience, and coming to a place where they desired to follow the Lord and thought doing that required leaving the Catholic Church. And then some years later, because that original decision was inspired by a desire to follow the Lord, they actually came back to the church. And one fellow I know actually tells me, well, I don't think it was right that I left the church to begin with, but I now understand why I did it and how God in his providence took took me in my sincerity and my desire to follow him and ultimately used that to bring me back to the church. So I think it's a complex situation with people. Lots of things go into how people make their decisions, but we shouldn't presume that somebody simply because he leaves the church is going to be damned. Nor should we presume that someone who leaves a church today won't come back tomorrow.
Joseph, does that help you?
Oh, yes. That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. That brings us to the break. We'll take a break. Be right back with more Ask Me Anything with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live. You're welcome to call if you've got a question. 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley, our guest. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and you are welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. I'm sorry, Mark. Usually when we're having a conversation during the break, I just let it go if we have to come back on the air. But now I got to know, you're working on an anthology of Catholic science fiction stories?
Of science fiction stories of, I'll say, Christian interest.
Oh, okay.
It isn't limited to Catholics, and the stories aren't necessarily specifically Catholic. Okay. Some of them are secular, and even, you know, by atheists, but they're of theological interest.
And any of them on, say, an artificial intelligence? Any of those in there?
Yes.
I'm just random curiosity.
Yeah. Yes. So there is one called Gus, and the author. The name of the author escapes me. I know this story very well. I've actually taught theology using it, and I'm drawing a blank on the author right now. But it's called Gus, and it's about a program that impersonates is a pejorative way of describing it, but it impersonates Saint Augustine. It's been programmed with the knowledge, if you call it knowledge. By analogy, we'll use the term knowledge, because unless you think artificial intelligences are really intelligences, you have to qualify the sense in which you speak of them having knowledge. Now, we get a long philosophical discussion because you say, well, do dogs have knowledge? Well, the answer is yes. Do they have intelligence? Well, they have a kind of intelligence. Do they have intellects in the proper sense? We're going to say no. And the same would be true of a program, an artificial intelligence program. But in any case, in the story, the premise of the story is that the technology is such that a so-called artificial Augustine is created. Now, he doesn't really think he's Augustine, but he answers questions with the knowledge base that Augustine possessed, insofar as that knowledge base has been expressed in his writings.
Who would do such a thing? Like,
yeah.
All right, back to the phones we go.
We could talk about that sometime. You know, it's more about that story, because I there's a whole conversation about can you do that, and there's a, I won't spoil the story, but there's an ethically problematic ending to the story that makes it really intriguing. You guys haven't had any any issues like this recently? Have you? Any topics?
Nothing comes to mind that's analogous. But I'll think about it. But the thing about artificial intelligence, one thing I have learned from various recent experiences I've had is that the term artificial intelligence is actually quite misleading because no machine can or ever will be able to do what a human being can do. There's like you said, we could use it as an analogy, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same order of thing. And I know there are many technologists who believe they're going to make a thing that is that can essentially do what the human mind can do. You can't do it. It's impossible. And I know why they don't believe it's impossible. They're materialists, but you cannot make a machine that can do what I'm doing right now, even though I'm doing it very poorly. you can't make a machine even to do it as poorly as I'm doing it.
Right. Right. It'd be interesting. You may have had somebody on the program to talk about this from a full philosophical point of view. We published a book by Michael Agras called The Immortal in You, which he makes the argument for the immateriality of the human intellect, and therefore, by implication, the impossibility of a machine or set of software running in a machine doing the things or doing the range of things that human beings can do. In other words, doing the specifically intellectual tasks of cognition and universal concepts and understanding, and certainly volition or freedom. So he makes that argument in the book. There's also, of course, Ed Fazer. Ed Fazer is publishing a book with someone else, but I've read his book on the immortality of the soul, and he similarly goes into the philosophy of mind and makes the argument about the immateriality of human intellect and therefore the inability of a machine to do all the things that human beings can do when they think and they choose. This is a really big issue. It's contested. As you say, there are technologists who think we will reach a threshold where the technology will be such that anything that a human mind can do, a machine will be able to do, and the so-called singularity that's a term that's attached to that, where there'll be a coming together of what humans can do and what machines can do, and the idea that then it may well be the case that machines surpass us. Of course, machines do surpass us in many things right now, calculation, things of that sort. But the distinctively human acts of intellection and generalized conceptual intelligence, those are not things that a machine, even the best programs thus far, have been able to show that they can do, so-called Turing test.
Yeah.
Alan Turing, who's a computer scientist, one of the pioneers in this, basically said when you can engage in an activity with a human being on the one hand and a machine on the other, and you can seal which is which, and you engage in a series of questions posed to both of them, when a human being is unable to distinguish interaction with the human being from interaction with the machine, that will show you that the machine can do everything that a human being can do.
It's not a good test.
It
won't work. I mean, clearly machines can be made to mimic us.
That's right.
Far beyond the human ability to make to distinguish. That doesn't mean the machine is doing what we're doing. It means the machine is very well designed. Because I realize some listeners may not know what you were referring to, but we're the people who created the robot priest about 10 or 12 days ago. Here. So if you don't know anything about that, just type the words robot priest into your machine and you'll get some articles about us. The number here is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Elizabeth is in Albany, New York. Thanks for waiting, Elizabeth, while we had that little chat. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Okay, I am a Catholic, and I am calling in regards to, I'll pull it up here, First Timothy 2:11 through 12, which says, "Let a woman learn in silence with full submission, I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She is to keep silent. So I've been thinking, since the church appoints female doctors, is the appointment of female church doctors a violation of this passage, since doctor means teacher?
Okay, very good question. I think the answer to that is no. And the question is, how should we understand this text? I think the context is Paul is addressing good order in the church, in the congregation. And apparently, there was some measure of disorder going on. And so he is intervening, and apparently this is true with respect to the letter he's addressing to Timothy. It's also true, we find in 1 Corinthians, a similar kind of situation. So it looks like from time to time in these early Christian communities, and by the way, you know, there was a kind of radicalness to early Christian communities because they were made up of males and females, and there was a basic kind of egalitarianism. Paul talks about this in Galatians 3:27, where he talks about it, with respect to baptism, there's no difference between male and female. That doesn't mean we become de-sexed. It means that with respect to the covenant, entering into relationship with God, men and women are on an equal footing. We're both baptized, right? And so that radical kind of egalitarianism within the early Christian communities, sometimes that led to misconduct on the part of men and women. And so sometimes women in these contexts, some women, not women generally, but some women engaged in disruptive behavior in the congregation. And it seems that Paul is addressing that here. And so he's saying, you know, women, when the elder or the priest is teaching, you should be quiet. You should receive instruction. You're not in a position of giving instruction. And so that's where he says in verse 12, I do not put a woman to teach or have authority over a man. She must be quiet, and so on and so forth. Now, in the particular, so I've mentioned the radical egalitarian context of early Christianity. I've also mentioned how that didn't mean there wasn't a difference between men and women, nor did it mean there wasn't a difference between elders and lay people in the congregation, nor did it mean that there were women elders. There were not. There were men elders or presbyters, what we today would call priests, just as there were men apostles who exercised a special role in terms of being a kind of sacramental representation of Jesus in relation to the church, his bride. So Paul makes the point that it's not the role of women to teach as elders in the church. But that doesn't mean that women don't have any teaching role whatsoever. And we know from 1 Corinthians that women were often engaged in prophesying, and prophesying is a kind of form of teaching or instruction. We know that there were other roles for women in the early church that allowed women to teach in certain contexts. But generally, the way the church has traditionally understood this passage in 1 Timothy chapter 2, it concerns women exercising the teaching role of a presbyter or an elder, basically what we would call a priest. And since that role is bound up with sharing in the teaching ministry or the teaching work of Jesus in relation to the church, that's not a role that's appropriate for a woman. It doesn't mean that women aren't appropriate teachers in other contexts. So it's basically reaffirming, as it were, the male-only priesthood, not the male-only role of teacher.
Does that work for you, Elizabeth?
It does, to an extent. I agree. Okay. I think the reason why I'm thinking this through a little bit more is because, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that when you are a doctor of a church, when you have that title of being doctor of the church, that seems to be like your teaching authority seems to be higher than that of your quote unquote average priest. Is that correct? So
yes and no. Yes and no. We would say a doctor of the church is not a Christ-established office in the church. bishop, priest, bishop and priest are offices established by Christ in the church. The diaconate is established by Christ in the church indirectly through the decision of the apostles. But these roles of this apostolic role of being authoritative witnesses to the teaching of Jesus, that is something that Jesus established. The office of doctor of the church is an honorary position that the church itself has established.
Elizabeth, thanks very much. We got to take a quick break. Mark Brumley is our guest. Ask Me Anything is the name of the show. 888-318-7884. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Mark Brumley is our guest, and you are welcome to call with your questions. 888-318-7884. You don't have to be Catholic to call. You don't have to be religious. You don't have to know anything about this stuff. If you want to know something about the Catholic faith, Catholic teaching, something you heard that a guy said about the Catholic Church and you want to find out if it's true, whatever, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884. We're going to TJ in Arizona watching on YouTube. TJ, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Oh, hi. I was just wanted to get you guys' opinion on it. Like, I was listening to the conversation, and you guys were talking about artificial intelligence, and I was reminded of a time when I argued with, like, ChatGPT, like, maybe a year ago. My reasoning was, like, well, if I can come to the conclusion myself through all the scholarship and evidence and so on and so forth that Christ is true, I was like, okay, let's see if this thing with all the evidence of the entire internet, you know, in its brain, if it could come to a similar conclusion. And it was fighting me tooth and nail with juvenile level, like kindergarten level answers. I was wondering what your opinion about that was.
I am shocked. I am shocked at that, that something programmed by people in Silicon Valley would give juvenile answers in regard to religion. That's just a smart aleck remark. Let's get a real intelligent comment from Mark Brumley.
Yours was intelligent. Well, TJ, I tell you the truth. I did a similar thing with it, and it lied to me.
What?
Yeah. It lied to me.
You caught it in a lie.
Well, I not culpably, but for Well, like it did something that's analogous to a lie. Let's call it that.
Yeah. So
what
so
did it do?
Yeah. I asked it a question and framed an argument and it gave a response and it I can't remember the details. I actually have it recorded someplace, you know, the text written down so I can prove it later on, but it gave a response and I challenged it and then it claimed that it did not give the response that it had given.
Whoa.
And I quoted it back to itself and its response was, well, you know, you have to be patient with me. I'm just a new AI and I'm still learning and all this kind of stuff. So I had a similar experience, TJ, just like little kids lie to you. Well, that's what this thing did.
I do think your experiment is interesting, though, TJ. This is supposed to draw from an enormous knowledge base, and be able to come up with conclusions, I suppose, is a way to say it, from all that. And you couldn't get it to conclude that Jesus was real, or you couldn't get it to conclude that Jesus was Messiah and Lord?
I was expecting it to give me, like, a really concise and seemingly authoritative, you know, final judgment conclusion type thing.
Oh, yeah.
And what I got was like I don't know if you'd watched the Ben Shapiro versus William Lane Craig like interview where they're going back and forth on the evidence for Christ, and it was a disappointment with Shapiro's kindergarten level responses. It's like superficial, like rebuttal, like, you know, like not deep diving level levels of research. So like I was getting that from ChatGPT. I was like, come on, you can do better than that. You know more. Like I like quote me this. It quotes me this. Like you know the arguments from this scholar. Okay, you know all of this. So put it together. What do you think? I think this because, you know,
sort of
the philosophy reasonings out there and all that stuff for the apostles, like nobody lies to get into trouble, that type of stuff. And its conclusion was like, well, I need more evidence. What more do you want? It's like, I don't know.
A soul? It's going to need a soul.
your Cy's point earlier, I think, is the strong one. And that is to say, this is not, there's nobody there. So this is not an intellect or a person that's taking the evidence and amassing it and so on. It is a program that's, you know, programmed to behave in a certain way and to bring in certain data and so forth and to give the appearance of a human being synthesizing a response. But that activity of a mind and a being with understanding exercising the judgment of an intellect and understanding, that's not real. It may seem that way on when you're dealing with trivial interactions, but when you get into these deep substantive questions that require an intellect to render a judgment, doesn't it be infallible? Because we have all of us, we human beings have intellects, but we make mistakes. But the ability to render a judgment is just absent from ChatGPT or any AI.
TJ, I want to keep you on because I'm interested in this discussion. I want to throw something out that I did with ChatGPT. And I have shared this before on the air. I read it on the air when I did it. I said to the ChatGPT, when does the life of a mammal begin? And the ChatGPT answered exactly correctly with scientific precision when the life of a mammal begins. And then it said, however, when it comes to human beings, this is a controversial issue. And it did all of this backpedaling and padding out so that I wouldn't have to acknowledge that what it had just said to me is evident for the life of a human being. Because, of course, a human being is a mammal. So if the life of a mammal begins at fertilization, then the life of a human begins at fertilization. But I read that to mean someone has programmed this machine not to offend someone who would be offended by that knowledge. Joe Heschmeyer, who was on the air with me, said, you know, it might not be that. It might be that there's so much misinformation and obfuscation out there in the world that the computer thinks that that's stuff that it has to express as well. So I don't know if it's malicious or if it's just accidental, but the machine doesn't want to make certain points. And so even if you could somehow, you know, quote unquote, convince it that Jesus is Lord and Messiah, I think it might be programmed not to come to certain conclusions.
So it's supposed to maintain this spectator sort of position, like on the fence about everything?
Even about scientific questions. I asked it a scientific question. When does the life of a mammal begin? And it told me the truth. And then it did, I don't know, two or three paragraphs of work to try to get me to not apply that truth to human beings.
I think that's a serious problem with the technology then. Like if it's encouraging people to not objectively define what is true or what isn't true, which seems to be the trend these days, I think the technology is, while it may have great potential, I've seen people do homework assignments and book reports, like it's obviously prone to lots of misuse, you know, with all these people that are, you know, that resort to Google and that type of thing to get their debunking answers out there, like their gotcha responses. This thing could be used maliciously, even if it's a brain dead, uncanny valley golem type thing in an AI sense.
Man, you hit all the buttons there. Like in one subordinate clause, you hit all the buttons. Mark, any last words on this one?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I would say we shouldn't expect more from AI than we expect from human beings, and that is many human beings, when they weigh up the evidence, they miss things, they misread things, they allow ambiguity to affect their thinking and misjudgment and so on, so that they don't always come to the right conclusions, especially about questions. You talk about, you know, is Jesus divine? Well, there's a way in which you can understand that question and generate an answer that is of a kind of probable nature. So, yeah, the best explanation, an argument to the best explanation, a lot of apologists will do this. So you take all the evidence regarding Jesus and what he said and did, and the idea that he was a liar or a lunatic or a legend or some other kind of and this kind of falls into the legendary category, that he said those things, but that he had another meaning to them, that kind of thing. When you take that, you know, go through all of that and you weigh up all the evidence, you come to the conclusion that the best explanation is that he is the Lord. He was who he said he was. Okay, well, that's an argument to the best explanation approach, but that's not really the act of faith that we make. You know, that may show that the act of faith is credible and believable, but if I ever had to die for the Lord, I'm not going to say, well, I'm dying for the Lord, because you take the weight of the evidence and the best explanation, the most probable explanation that accounts for all this evidence is that he was the Lord. I'm going to say, this is someone I know and love who's transformed my life. That, and so therefore, I give my all for him. If you want to ask, is that a credible, reasonable act that I'm making, or is it just, you know, brain dead fantasy? I can articulate arguments of that sort. But that's something very different from the very human act of personal commitment that's involved in the act of faith. And no machine's going to do that. Mm-hmm.
TJ, thanks for an interesting conversation. We got to take a very quick break. This is a real short one. Then we'll be right back to calls after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. and the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the greatest defenders of Christ's divinity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Athanasius of Alexandria fought against the Arian heresy that questioned the divinity of Christ. He once condemned the Arians as opposers of Christ who had dug a pit of ungodliness. It was said of him, Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world, but for Christ. He died in 373.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest. He's the president of Ignatius Press, and you can find them at ignatius.com. All kinds of wonderful things over there for you to check out. Chloe's in Texas watching on YouTube, and she's got a question. Go ahead. Oh, hang on, Chloe. I hit the wrong button. I hardly ever do that. If you know me at all, you know I hardly ever do that, Chloe. Go ahead with your question.
Hi.
Hi.
So I was given the assignment in my college English class to debate the topic of whether is the world good or bad, or are humans naturally selfish and evil, or basically decent. And I was wondering how the topic of free will and original sin plays into this question, and how I could use those to, you know, to use to my ability and, I guess, win the debate.
Are you taking the side that humans are good or that humans are bad?
I would vouch that humans are good. It's just that we have free will, and
yeah.
So I was watching a video last night, and one thing that stuck out to me is that our yes means nothing if we cannot say no. That's really what I want to vouch for.
Well, one of our favorite things to do on this radio program is people's college homework, Chloe. So you have come to the exact right place, Mark Brumley.
Yay!
Write her paper for or help her in the debate, will you, Mark?
I'm talking to ChatGPT right now. Chloe, I'll get you an answer and we'll email it to you.
4.3 seconds, you will have an answer.
That's right. That's right. So it's interesting because it seems to me that the premise of the assignment, if I understand correctly, is to argue either that that human beings in the world are good or human beings in the world are bad. Is that correct? Is that the premise of the assignment?
Yes. Like, see, the question, it's so broad, and that's what's like keeping me in the mud right now.
Okay.
Okay.
So it seems to me that premise assumes freedom, some measure of freedom, because if to say somebody is evil is to say someone mm-hmm. has chosen to do a bad thing or chosen to do bad things. To say someone is good is to say that someone has chosen to do good things, right? So by implication, if you say, are people evil or are people good, you're implying that there's a level of freedom. Now, you could step back and ask a more fundamental question, and that may not be the question that the assignment is getting at, or it may be, which is, are people intrinsically or by nature good or evil? That's a different question. Talk about, do people tend to make evil choices and choose evil things, or do people tend to make good choices, choose good things, or is it somewhere in between? That's one question. But then to go back and ask the question about someone's nature and say, well, is someone so bad, is their nature bad in such a way that they're incapable of choosing anything but evil, or their nature is good in such a way that they're incapable of choosing anything other than what's good? I don't think that's the question that your teacher's probably asking you to answer, but it could be, so I'm going to ask you about that.
Chloe?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Is that what your teacher's asking?
I don't think so. See, the question was more like, like, should we look at the world in an optimistic way or a pessimistic way?
Oh, okay. So what do you think?
I would say optimistic, because, like...
Okay. Well, let me ask you, Chloe. So are you a Catholic?
Oh, yes, I'm cradle Catholic, so I...
Okay. So here's the question for you. So you say we should look at the world in an optimistic way. How do you reconcile that kind of optimism with the Catholic and more generally the Christian doctrine of original sin?
That is such a deep question. Oh my gosh, what did you just ask me?
Yeah, it is a deep question, but you're in college. Because, you can handle it, Chloe.
Yeah, you can do it, Chloe. We trust
like,
you.
It would mean we're all born in a state of disconnection from one another, from God, in a state of tendency towards doing evil and sin. How could you reconcile that with your optimistic view?
Well, we are made from love, and
that's right.
In Genesis, when we are made, God says it is good, and then He goes, it is very good.
Nice.
I mean, we are made to love and with love. We were made to do good things.
Oh, I knew Chloe could do it. Nailed it.
I think you're onto something there, Chloe. We'd say even though there is a thing called original sin, even though that's a reality, nevertheless, we retain our fundamental human goodness, and there's a sense in which we're still oriented to the good. Even when we choose bad things because they appear in some way or another good for us or good to us. And so that's part of the hard wiring of being made in the image of likeness of God. Now, even though we have a tendency to sin, God's grace has not left us alone. God's grace is moving and active and trying to lead us and give us the opportunity to choose good as well. So we have ourselves, our basic being made in the image and likeness of God, which has a kind of freedom. We have our fallenness, which is a result of original sin, and it has limited or damaged but not entirely eliminated our freedom. And then we have God's grace working at us, just the same grace, the same love of God that created us in His image and likeness and called us to know Him is present to us in the form of grace. Now, ultimately, that grace is moving us towards encounter with God through Jesus Christ in baptism and the life of the Spirit. But even before that, or outside of that, God's grace hasn't abandoned the human race, and God is trying to move us and take us in the direction of good, and away from the choices of evil. So, I think you're onto something there when you point to the fact that we were made out of love, we were made for love, and even sin, as bad as it is, and as much harm as it inflicts, and we see it operative in the world, doesn't defeat God's love. And that's why I'm gonna challenge you on something. I'm gonna say Christians aren't necessarily optimistic or pessimistic, but we're gonna say we're hopeful. That is to say, we hope and rely on God, who is the source of this good creation, and is the source of redemption, and is the source of love that we experience. That He's gonna come through for us in the end.
That's amazing. I'm going to write that down. That was beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, very good.
I'm
not sure we're helping with the paper. Making the paper more complicated.
I want to know the grade that Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, gets on your college paper, Chloe. So you're going to have to call us back when he's on again and tell us how Mark did. I got to keep going, though, Chloe, because I want to try to get some more folks on before we have to go. But thank you. It was delightful to talk with you. Shireen is in Springfield, Illinois, listening on 88.9 FM. Shireen, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Thank you. My question is this. If a person who's Catholic receives communion but does not believe in the real presence, how does that affect that?
How does that affect what?
Well, you know, if you're Catholic, we're taught that the body and blood of Christ is right. what we have when we receive the, when it's been, I can't think of the word, transform of the priest.
Transubstantiated, yes. Or consecrated, yes. Or, right, okay.
If you believe
confected.
That, if you believe that the host is bread and that the fluid is wine instead of the body and blood of Christ, when you receive communion, how would that affect the reception?
So it would not mean that the Eucharist is not the body and blood of Christ. A person's
right.
subjective disposition doesn't make it the body of Christ or keep it from being the body of Christ, but it would
okay.
mean that it is not an appropriate reception of Holy Communion for a Catholic.
Okay.
So, you know, it means that somebody has rejected some aspect of the Catholic faith and is nevertheless choosing to receive the Eucharist, which is not something someone who has rejected the Catholic faith should do. That's disrespectful
okay.
to the sacrament itself, and it's certainly disrespectful to the community of believers.
Are they still Catholic?
Maybe
I'm asking the wrong question, but if I were to go up to communion, and I thought, well, I don't believe in the transubstantiation. I still I think that's just, you know, that's something that
right.
somebody made up, you know, and I don't have to choose to believe it. Then how would that
right.
affect? Am I still receiving the body and blood of Christ? I mean, I would be right.
That would be heresy. And it would be alienating oneself from the faith of the church. And if you did that freely and knowingly, it would be a mortal sin. It would be gravely sinful. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes. So, well, almost.
Okay.
So then
okay.
if you do that the first once, and then each consecutive time you go back up to the communion to receive the body and blood of Christ with the same idea, then you're committing mortal sins each time.
Yes. Assuming
oh,
that you know what you're doing is wrong and you're freely choosing to do it, sure, yes.
Okay. But what if they don't think that they're wrong? I mean, they think...
Well, then, okay, so there could be a situation where someone doesn't understand that the Catholic Church teaches what it teaches about the Eucharist, and that person can think, well, the Church is just teaching that this is a symbol, and therefore, I can receive the symbol of Jesus' body and blood. That person would be mistaken. It's contrary to what the church believes. A person should be corrected, but that person wouldn't necessarily be committing a grave sin because, you know, we're presuming that he's just doesn't know and understand what he's doing.
Person is not a young person, is a born Catholic. But I don't know. I was listening the other night, and I can't say too much more.
No, that's all right. But I do think people of all ages make mistakes. But
right.
we also all do wrong. So I don't know. We're in a position to judge that. But we're. I don't want to let you go without offering you a book. We have a book called "The Eucharist Is Really Jesus" by Joe Heschmeyer, and
okay.
since this question has come up, I'd be happy to send it to you. Free of charge, because we can send to Springfield, Illinois, from here without
way over there.
We can send it all the way there to Springfield, Illinois, and we'd be happy to send it to you. So you hang on the line because the music is going to start playing in just a second, Shireen. Very happy that we had the chance to talk, but we'd love to give you the book. Just stay on the line, and we'll send you "The Eucharist Is Really Jesus" by Joe Heschmeyer. Sorry to those we didn't get to. Are we doing Ask Me Anything tomorrow, Darren? We don't know what we're doing. We're gonna, you know what we're having? A great show tomorrow. I'll tell you that. We don't know who's on, but we're going to work the next 24 hours to make it great. Mark Brumley is president of Ignatius Press. I'm looking forward to his book that he's going to edit on Christian-themed science fiction stories. Mark, thanks for doing the hour with us.
Happy to do it.
Check out everything they got over there, Ignatius.com, including the new book that Mark recommended from Pope Benedict. Well, that'll do it for us. We don't actually know what we're doing on the air tomorrow, but I promise you, it's going to be a thrill a minute. See you then, God willing. Catholic Answers Live.